Hello, hello. I am Manopi, welcoming you to the From Surviving to Thriving Creativity and Mental Health podcast series. These podcast series are designed and delivered by the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and funded by the Bearing Foundation. These podcast series were born on the back of a research report, and the report's main focus has been on developing a model that helps us build a sustainable practice in arts and mental health. As part of these podcast series, we are hoping to dive deeper into this model and discuss its recommendations focused on five core groups: practitioners, commissioning organizations, funders, researchers, and infrastructure organizations. On this episode, we are going to be focusing on the recommendations for commissioners and what the report means to commissioners within the arts, culture, and health space. So, to that extent, I am very excited to welcome our guests for today's conversation. A very warm welcome to Gemma Channing, who is the Health and Wellbeing Coordinator at Canterbury Museums and Galleries, and Matthew Walsh, who's had a long, illustrious career at the NHS, including being the Chief Executive at NHS Calderdale CCG, before setting up his consultancy business that currently keeps him busy. So a very, very warm welcome, Matt and Gemma. It's absolutely brilliant to have you both join me today. I'm going to start off by sort of asking both of you to tell me a little bit more about you, your background, your journey so far, if that's okay. Gemma, would you like to kickstart us on this one?
Lovely, yeah. So my name is Gemma, and my current role is Health and Wellbeing Coordinator at Canterbury Museums and Galleries. Before working in museums, I worked for the NHS as an occupational therapist in mental health inpatient services. And before I did that, I worked in health promotion. So I've taken a strange route to museums. The majority of my career has been around health. When I was working on inpatient wards, that's when I got interested in using arts and culture and heritage to support our patients' well-being. And that kind of started this journey. And here I am now working in a museum, still a registered occupational therapist.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Gemma, for that. Matt.
So, hello, I'm Matt Walsh. I have spent most of my life in the NHS. I have been a general practitioner for a long time, actually, a long time. I qualified in Leeds in 1987 and then did my GP training and became a GP in Bradford in the early 1990s, and then developed an interest in leadership, clinical leadership, making things better, trying to get the system to work for the people who I was looking after. And then stepped into senior management roles in various organisations across West Yorkshire, finishing up as the chief officer for Calderdale CCG, where I was for about 12 years until a couple of years ago when I stepped out. And I'm now working as a coach and a mentor for people following the same sort of journey that I followed in clinical practice and then in leadership, and always really connected personally to creativity, arts, music, poetry, and latterly in the later stages of my career in Calderdale, really began to understand the power of a conversation that's much more about humanity than it is about healthcare, actually. That's why I'm really interested and curious about the power and potential of this relationship between creativity and health and well-being. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us, and great to have you here. So I think what would be interesting would be to find out a little bit more about what is currently keeping you busy. And I know, Gemma, you've mentioned that you've had a couple of exhibitions that you've been busy with. So yes, it would be great to find out a little bit more about what's keeping you busy right now.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I have been busy with some exhibitions. So I work from the Beanie House of Art and Knowledge is the museum that I work from. And I have just curated an exhibition called A Place of Safety, which is about sort of the history of mental health and how environments and activities feed into mental health and how they have done for millennia, actually. Art therapy and music therapy was being used by the ancient Greeks. This is ancient knowledge that we're still using today. Curating that exhibition has been the privilege of a lifetime, really, to be able to talk about something that really matters to me and to have artwork from previous Bethlehem patients, people like Richard Dadd and Louis Wayne, but also there's a big kind of patient voice throughout it. So we've been working with our local mental health trust, Kent and Medway Partnership Trust, and six of the inpatient wards have been working with occupational therapists and led by drama therapists to make artwork for the exhibition about their experience of life on the ward, about their experience of mental illness, dementia, or just life, really. And they've written some poems, they've written some poems and done some paintings and made some one wall. Or some willow lanterns to kind of symbolise hope. So that's been keeping me nice and busy. Now that the exhibition is up, a lot of my work is welcoming people to the exhibition. So today we've had some senior kind of service lead people from NHS came to have a look at the exhibition and just to talk to us about what we're doing and find out a bit more about what we as a museum are doing, sending loan boxes out onto their wards and why we're doing it, and which has been great to talk to them directly about what we're doing. But also facilitating patient visits, which has been lovely. Yesterday, one of the dementia wards who have made artwork for the exhibition came, and Kate, the drama therapist who's facilitated that, the group and the visit, said that one of the patients that came hasn't left the ward in months and doesn't usually even want to get out of bed. But when she found out that they were going to a museum, she was like, yep, I want to come. Really enthusiastic, came, had a lovely time, had a cup of coffee. So, yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff at the moment, making people feel welcome and just really talking about what we're doing. I think advocating probably is a large part of my role, advocating for trying to get funding and trying to spread the message and get these things in place for patients and people as much as we possibly can, really.
So before I start, I'm really interested in what you're talking about, Gemma, in particular. So I'm really struck by the name of the place that you're working. This house of art and knowledge, and I think that's really powerful. I'm kind of wondering where the name came from? Who thought of that name? Because I'm really interested in the relationship between art, creativity, and knowledge, and heart and passion. That's what kind of conjures up for me. This combination of wisdom, a place where we find wisdom. That's what it gives me. Is that what it's meant to give me?
So the name of the Beanie is from, so it was founded by Dr. Beanie in Canterbury, I think in 1889. Don't quote me on that. I know I'm literally going to be quoted on that. At the end of the 19th century, Dr. Beanie, he was in Canterbury. He was a doctor, a medical doctor, and he went to Australia and made his fortune in pharmaceuticals and then came back to Canterbury, and he gave this building to the city of Canterbury And it was meant as a space where anyone, regardless of class, financial status, could come and they could access books and they could see. He was quite a sort of traditional Victorian collector of objects, and it was like a free space that people could come to learn, whether they could, and there was no entry fee. So it was built as this kind of open resource. And then over the years, it's kind of developed. And there was a refurb about 10 years ago where that's where the, and then from then, the sort of more targeted health and wellbeing works started then. But the, I think the Art and Knowledge name actually goes back quite far. I don't know if it's on the, like, it's on the very old Victorian sign outside our museum.
Yeah,
it is quite a nice name. It's a mouthful.
It's beautiful. It's, yeah, but it's back to what you were saying. You know, these, the ideas that we're playing with, doing more than playing with, we're working with, is that these are ancient ideas. These are, this is ancient knowledge, isn't it? And the that's really helpful. It's really helpful because it's woven into us. It's woven into us. It's part of who we are. And this this challenge that we're talking about today, the challenge that we're talking about today is less about people and more about institutions, I think. It's reconnecting us as institutions to the reality of human nature, people, and what makes them tick. Is what I think anyway. So what? How do I spend my time? I think was, is that the exam question? Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing to say is that I am really proud that I've been asked to co-chair the Creative Health and Wellbeing Alliance, and that I was appointed into that role about 6 months ago now, and I'm really loving discovering more about the power and the potential of this space, and the Creative Health and Wellbeing Alliance increasingly clear about the purpose of our work, which is to convene space and to enable conversations to happen between people who are creative and people who are working in health care and well-being, and just convening that space and helping to shape conversations, because these conversations just take a life of their own, but having the courage to hold that space, which I think is really, really powerful and really, really important, a really important function. So I'm really enjoying learning about what's going on in this space between the world of healthcare and the world of creativity, and connecting people and being part of a process that connects people is really energizing, I think. My day today. So I spent the first hour today out on my bike. I go out on my bike every morning, and I travel the same route every day. Every day I just go up to the top of the hill. It takes me about 50 minutes, and every day I see something different and beautiful. And every day I come back and I write about it. I write a poem and I put it out on Twitter. So I write the poem every day about what I've noticed. And the reason I do that is because I need to be connected to the beauty of the world. I need to make an effort to be connected to the beauty of the world. And that's my way of doing it. And I'll tell you, it has done me so much good psychologically, mentally, physically, to commit to doing that, writing about it and noticing what's going on around me has been a really beautiful thing for me over the last couple of years. And having the time to do that has been really powerful. And then I spent a couple of hours coaching somebody. So somebody who works in the world of housing. And so I'm trying to, most of my coaching so far has been with people who are doctors working in the NHS, but I'm trying to get out into the world and I'm curious about the power of coaching in all sorts of contexts. So I'm really interested in that. And then I've been involved in an organisation called the Inspiring Leaders Network. So we work principally with healthcare organisations, doing a programme called The Shadow Board, where people who are wanting to get to director level in their organisations go through a programme that we've constructed that helps them to understand what the responsibilities of a director in the NHS look like. And in all of that, I'm introducing ideas about joy and hope. You talked about hope, Gemma. And so one of the modules that I'm connected to is about system working and all of the stuff that's going on at the moment about working more collegiately as systems, integrated care systems, and the opportunities there. But very importantly then about resilience, what we mean about it, joy, how do we create it for ourselves and the people around us, and hope, and what do we mean by the word hope? What are the risks of creating hope, and what are the opportunities of creating a better present? And it's that kind of conversation that I'm really interested in. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm doing at the moment, and I'm finding it really, really energizing, and kind of think I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing at the moment.
It sounds like you're doing some very interesting, varied stuff, Matt. And I'm definitely going to follow you on Twitter now to check out your poems. That's for sure. I think we sort of already touched upon this, my next question around sort of highlighting the impact of arts and creativity and having that creative mindset and what that means on our mental health. You know, Matt, you've already mentioned about your sort of daily ritual. And, you know, Gemma, you've highlighted somebody moving out from her or his bed, you know, just to be a part of that visit. So there are thousands and thousands of such examples. But I would love to ask both of you if there's any one specific example that you want to highlight that really shows the impact of arts and creativity on mental health.
Yeah, I'll have a go. I mean, I think I'd probably start with experiencing my role as a GP, actually, and finding ways of connecting with people and deepening relationship, and having common ground. So what I found that talking about what people love to do, so in consultation with people who were having difficulties, having conversations with people to help them to reconnect to things that really give them purpose, ways of expressing yourselves, connecting better to ourselves, and having conversations about the sorts of things that enable people to express themselves commonly took me into conversations about writing and stories and painting and drawing and colouring in, and, you know, things that create a different space in our heads to enable us to think differently about our relationship with the world. So I found, and I'm not sure I'd call that therapeutic, and I think it's just part of creating deeper understanding and deeper relationship, actually, and building trust. So I kind of think it's been important to me in my professional life in those terms, in terms of just creating a change in the nature of the conversation, bringing it out of the strictly medical into me in my life and what matters to me and how I'm feeling about my life and myself and my relationships. I just found conversations taking me there. I'm not saying that I introduced these ideas. You know, I didn't say, do you think it'd be a good idea if? Most of the time, people offered this themselves. What do you really love doing? Somebody who's really down, somebody who's really finding it difficult, what do you love doing? And how can we connect you more to that? And how do we create a sense of purpose when it's difficult to find hope? Those conversations, I thought, were quite powerful in my experience in my role as a GP. And then I'm again struck, Gemma, by the story you told about people with dementia and the lights that come on and the stories that people can reconnect to when we create opportunity to connect through art and story and music. And I guess so my mum was ill with dementia. She died probably about 9 months ago now, but for the last 2 years of her life she was in a care home, and it was at a really difficult time during COVID where visiting was difficult and things were quite distant. But I can remember going and seeing my mum sitting, and this was not what my mum loved to do when she was herself. She was quite a private person, but she was, I watched her, part of a group singing, they were singing a song and they were playing music. And she looked like herself. She was alive. She was connected to people through that experience. And I'm sure that that the impact wasn't felt for long by her, but for those moments, actually, she was back to being something like herself. And just the power of witnessing that and the joy of knowing that she was able to make a connection was really powerful for me, really powerful for me, actually.
Yeah, I've had sort of similar experiences, actually, Matt, in that it was, so my granddad had dementia and he passed away probably about 9 months ago. And I think music was probably one of the last things that he could enjoy because it's not time bound. You don't need any equipment. You can just sit and enjoy it. And that's something that I think is that it's so powerful to be able to, as you say, like you start seeing like a bit of the life coming back into the person because it's something that they can do. And it's not about curing people or recovery even. It's actually about like the moments that you get with people. And especially with dementia, from my experience of working on dementia wards, I know that it's, people might forget who you are and they might forget what they've done that afternoon, but they'll remember that they had a good feeling. And they'll remember that they felt good in that moment. And one of the when I worked in mental health, we had a patient choir, which was a few different wards would come together, and it was led by a music therapist. And to see patients that would kind of be sat silently a lot of the time come into this room, and then it wasn't just singing, you'd have dancing and clapping along, and then they would be choosing different songs. It sparks conversation as well, and they said like a bit of reminiscence that comes with it. It's a really good way of getting to know someone as a human being. We talk, so me and Kate, who's the drama therapist who I worked on the exhibition with, we talk about personhood, not patienthood. When people go onto mental health wards, they are then a patient, and we are the staff. And there's this immediate barrier, but I found that it was art and creativity and drama and music, all of these things were really good ways to get to know someone and kind of move away a bit more from these kind of professional patient roles and just kind of connect as people. And finding out the most interesting things about people, like some of the patients that we had like wallpaper designers that made like the most beautiful things. And I never would have found out these aspects of their history through a mental state examination. It just wouldn't happen. But, you know, we all sit down, we all get involved, we all do the activities. And by sharing a bit of myself as well, by being there and participating in the art, it makes them feel a bit more like they can trust me and that we're meeting on a level, not as like a hierarchical, I am the well one with the lanyard and you are the patient, and I am the one that will treat you. It becomes more like conversational than treatment based. So I think for me, working on the mental health wards was a huge insight into how art is, it can be a tool for like making people feel relaxed enough to reveal parts of themselves to you that you never would find in any medical examination.
Absolutely, and couldn't agree more. Such powerful thoughts shared there. And I think, you know, that's the real beauty of arts and creativity. It allows you to bring your whole self in and without judgment, without that thing about, like you said, Gemma, that I am this role and you are this person that I need to treat. It's about just bringing your whole self, finding joy in doing anything, you know, anything small or big. And really building in that self-awareness, because I think, you know, when you talk about mental health, being aware about yourself as an individual is such an important part of taking care of your mental health. So giving that person that freedom, really, that these are some tools, use it as per your convenience, see what you like, don't like. So I'm an Indian classical dancer and I work with communities and use movements to bring joy, to bring hope. And I was working through winter last year with care homes. And, you know, when the lady introduced me from the care home, she's like, oh, she's going to do some Indian classical movements. And I could see most of the people sitting in the lounge be like, we are not interested in this place. But I think, you know, it was very interesting to see that how just by empowering them that you could move your thumb left and right, just a simple thing as that could mean you're feeling joy or you're not feeling joy. That just those very simple movements actually made them realize, oh, I didn't know I could move my thumb like this, you know, and that gave them that sense of, I guess, independence that, oh, you know what? I'm not completely reliant. I can do things myself as well. And that itself was just, it was so empowering to see that small shift in mindset impacted the way they behaved for the rest of the day, impacted the way they slept, the way they, you know, were accepting medication. You know, it was that sort of ripple impact, which is hard to describe through evaluation forms, but it's that ripple impact that really makes what the space so so amazing and so beautiful, so powerful as well. So it's fantastic to hear some great examples from both of you. So on that note, I think it'll be interesting to dive straight in into the report, because that's what we're going to talk about. One of the things that was definitely our focus when we were building this report was to make it as representative and as relevant as we possibly can for individuals working and engaging within the culture, arts, and mental health space. So I would love to find out what are your first impressions about the report. So Gemma, do you want to start us off on this one?
Yeah, I guess like one of my questions was like, thank God it's here, because this is such a necessary thing that we need at the moment. I think this is quite a pivotal time in terms of coming out of COVID and the kind of different health issues that the country is facing, but also in terms of where we've reached so far in the arts and health sector. To have this report that presents a model is really timely, and it's as more and more people are kind of getting in and understanding this need for like health and well-being to be incorporated into the fabric of museums and galleries, particularly, that there's something there that I can show people and say, like, this is a starting point. This is like some considerations and some research and some information that's going to help you kind of pin your work on it. And I think it really kind of, it addresses that fundamental issue of language when we're working across sectors by using the same terminology and giving definitions. I think that has been a problem for as long as I've been working in health and the arts, is how do we kind of define what engagement is and what co-production is. And to have it laid out like that, I think, makes it really easy for people to start planning their work and to start communicate what they're doing between each other, but outside as well. And I think it's really going to help not just to articulate the value of creativity for well-being more, but actually on a practical level, if this can be sort of assimilated, it will make day-to-day interactions easier, and working with each other easier, and working kind of across sectors a lot easier. And I really like that it looks at the wider kind of context of health, moving away from this idea of just kind of conditions and diagnosis and treatment, which like those thoughts do have a value, and that it, like, is an important aspect of health, but they're only really a small part of the picture. And instead, I think looking at those wider determinants of health and how they interact and how they contribute to ill health, I think that's really key. I think going forward, that's going to be more of what our work is. Because then we're all the time that we're responding to sort of people that are already unwell, we're a lot more reactive. And I think as a sector, we have the enthusiasm and we have the skills and we have the knowledge and the expertise and the energy to actually be proactive and start thinking, what can we do that's actually going to keep people well for longer rather than only addressing it later down the line. So, yeah, I think it's quite, for me, I found it quite an exciting, empowering, like energizing read.
So I've got similar reflections to Gemma on this. So the experience I had in Calderdale, where I was involved for a little while in doing some thinking across the local system about how we create a relationship between the worlds of creativity and the world of health and care. And we're talking about a period probably shortly after the publication of Creative Health, so the APPG report that came out, I think, in 2017. And so as a system in Calderdale, we were really up for a different sort of conversation about how we might do some work together in that space. But we were starting from nowhere. Whilst we had the APPG report that did some really good work in terms of mapping out what the benefits might be, actually what the APPG report doesn't do is tell you how you might go about starting. And so what I think this report does is help organisations and systems that want to make a start on creating a new relationship and a new way of being, a new, to your point, Gemma, about moving the focus, not shifting it completely from managing illness, because we have to do that, but how do we shift our collective focus further upstream into the things that keep us well and happy? And this guide is not a blueprint. I worry if people take it away and use it as a blueprint, because I don't think it's meant to be that. I think this is a foundation. This is a starting point for a conversation, because my experience in Calderdale was some of this we would do this way, but some of this we might do something different, or do it in a slightly, or give the responsibility to a different bit of the system, because some of this is context specific and about the place and about the relationships. But at least here you've got a foundation and you've got a framework and you've got a set of proposals that give you something to have a conversation about. And we didn't have that. We had to knit our own. We had to find our own way through. And that was, these are hard yards, actually, because the cultures that we're talking about are very different. You talk about language and there's some really different ways of thinking and behaving in these worlds, but here we are with something that you can start to have a different conversation with, and I think that is a real gift. It's a real gift to organizations and systems. It's beautiful, but what it doesn't do is give you the leadership, give you the energy, give you the appetite. That's got to come from the place. And that's another whole set of challenges, I think.
Yeah, I think both of you all have touched upon some very key aspects of the report. Like you mentioned, Matt, it is building that foundation. It is that reference model that gives you the tools to then have those conversations. And Gemma, like you mentioned, about moving from reactive stuff to being proactive. And I think that's going to be key to making this space sustainable, you know, moving from just surviving to actually thriving. So thank you so much for sharing your sort of first thoughts about the report. And one of the things which was very key to building this thriving practice model was to build recommendations for 5 core groups, with the understanding that each of us has a role to play. You know, each of us, it's about co-sharing. It's about doing your own bit in the larger scheme of things. But when we look at it specifically in terms of the recommendations for commissioners, what I would love to know from both of you is that, was there any specific recommendation in that list that resonated most with you? And if so, why? Gemma.
Yeah, that is a good question. I read through the commissioner section, and I really liked the focus on how creative work can be a catalyst for sort of systemic change, and that importance of looking at structural inequalities to really make those changes that we need to. Essentially, what I liked about it was that it's calling on organisations and commissioners to practice what they preach. Do we represent our community, like in terms of like diversity and how representative we are as commissioners? And if we don't, what is it that we're doing to address that? And again, that lived experience that was fed into it as well, that sort of leadership by lived experience, which is something that I think is happening, and it's happening more and more in different organisations. But it did make me think, is that something that we're doing enough of? It's that, and in what way? So I guess, like you were saying before, like it's a framework and it's a foundation to kind of look at what you're doing. And not only can you use them as like considerations for when you're starting to do work, but actually while we're already doing work, it helped me identify actually there are some things that we could be working on. And I think that leadership of lived experience and the like the expert of by lived experience, I think that's something that is, I actually can't think of many commissioners that are doing that to the level that this report recommends. Not that it means that we're like we have to go out there and do it tomorrow. It's just thinking about then it's that taking a step back and like, well, why haven't we been doing that? What is it that we need to do? Is this because it feels like we're handing over control, or is it because we don't really know how to do it and we're not quite confident enough yet to kind of instigate that work? So it's been quite useful in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think personally, I feel like the report could be a great way to build a reflective space to really understand what you've done so far. You know, there are many things that a lot of organizations have already done. So sort of tapping into what you've already done. And like you said, Gemma, it's not like you need to go out there and do everything overnight. But the idea is to start that conversation to make things part of the agenda, part of your discussions and those conversations. So that's great to hear. Matt?
Yeah, so there were a couple of things that resonated for me on the commissioning front. I need to find a way of saying this that doesn't sound too critical. But I guess my... my experience working in the NHS is that we're not good at taking risks. We worry a lot about whether things are safe. And sometimes that anxiety gets in the way of change. One of the things that's going on at the moment, one of the new movements that is in support of all of this work is social prescribing. And the role of primary care in signposting people to opportunities to participate in more creative activity, that kind of thing. And there's some risk in there, I think a little bit along the lines, Gemma, that you were talking about, this idea that you've got to go to the doctor to get a prescription for some art is like the opposite of a good idea. What I think comes through really clearly, though, is this sense that practitioners need to be safe. And this idea of the lone practitioner, or isolated practitioners, offering support without a framework of support around them, I think it's really helpful in this guidance that we're steering people towards thinking about what is the infrastructure, what is the safety net, what is the support that needs to wrap around initiatives around creativity and creative health. How do we keep that safe for everyone? Clients, commissioners, practitioners, and I think it's really helpful to bring a focus on that, so that the conversations happen, so that we actually have conversations at local levels about making sure that people are safe without getting in the way, without stopping things from happening. That's the art. That will be the art of doing this well, is balancing our appetite to do this with our need to just make sure everything's safe. So that's really helpful. The other thing that I'm really struck by and thinking a lot about at the moment is what's the value that we place on this? How do we pay people? How do we pay people in a way that makes this sustainable? How do we demonstrate to the creative people in our midst that we love them enough to pay them properly? When we look at the experience of creative people in terms of making a living, it's not a good story. It's not a good story. Most people don't make a living out of being creative. And if we believe that creativity and creative talent is fundamental to the way that we create places and create communities, we've got to attend to that. And then we get into a conversation about, so who says who's an artist? Who says who's a poet? Who says who's a musician? How do we know that they're delivering value? But we need to start having that conversation. So I think that's helpful, because it will precipitate a conversation about how do we value this? How do we value it?
I completely agree. There is mass sort of diverse discrepancies in terms of pay, and it's also something in healthcare as well. Like, how do you value someone giving a therapeutic intervention? How do you value someone giving you sharing their creativity? It's there's no banding for it, but there are some sort of equity rates, I know, for arts. But I know that a lot of creatives are scared of asking for that wage because they feel like they'll be turned down. So I think that's like one of the responsibilities of like commissioning organisations, is to make sure that we are paying the rate that, like, as a bare minimum, the rates that are set by equity, and that actually we don't accept people that offer less, because not because we think that they're worth less or because we don't think they're doing their job right, but actually to set that precedent that, like, you know what, no, this work is valuable. We're putting people's well-being in your hands, therefore it's X amount of money. It's just such a the ongoing difficulty in this sector is that the kind of things that we value and the kind of outputs that we value are not numerical, and are by their nature very difficult to measure. They are experiences, they are personal kind of feelings and emotions and connections. How can you measure how connected someone feels? How can you measure there are kind of confidence scales and depression scales, but what we do is so difficult to capture, and then that's reflected in the work that is done by creatives is so difficult to capture. How do you then quantify it? So I'm sure there's a research paper in there somewhere.
So there's a paradigm shift, and that's one of the things that flows from this anxiety, this risk low risk appetite in healthcare around this, because we are we're persuaded by data more easily than we're persuaded by stories, and we need to change. If we want to be part of a conversation about how we create more humane, more human spaces, more human communities, then we have to be willing to look at different ways of measuring impact. And there is some really interesting work going on at the moment, and some interesting research work going on at the moment around how you might reframe the way that you measure success in terms of the stories that people tell about their sense of control of their destiny, their sense of empowerment, their sense of purpose. I think that that's a really important dimension for colleagues in health and care to think about carefully.
This was one of the reasons that I think that occupational therapists are quite well placed in the arts, like for health sector, not just because I'm an occupational therapist, so I'm advocating for my profession, but because fundamentally the occupational therapy is promoting participation in the things that matter to that person. And we do have kind of our own OT-based tools where we measure things like motivation and participation and levels of engagement and things like that. And it's not perfect, but it is. We are kind of measuring human aspects of a human experience. And I would imagine as well across other professions that I know less about, I'm thinking like the psychologies, there may even be tools out there that can be kind of adapted. Like, I think that is probably where researchers and commissioners need to work quite closely together, because we understand as commissioners that we need to prove something to the funders, and to be able to prove something, we need the tools, and that's where the researchers come in. So it's this sort of strand of co-production that is through the report is so important, because unless we are all working together in tandem, it is all going to fall apart.
Yeah, agree. But this document helps to bind those organisations together in a way that, you know, potentially could begin to open up a different conversation about how we recognise and reward and how do we demonstrate impact.
Yeah, I think it's that. And it's nice to have something to kind of refer to and to refer other people to, so it doesn't just sound like me banging on at someone. It's like, no, this is like, it is linked to like an actual piece of text. This isn't one of my thoughts that's just got out of control. So I think it's a nice way to kind of articulate how powerful partnership work can be, because I don't think it's always necessarily quite so clear to see. So it's another kind of tool to advocate and be like, work with us and do research with us, because this is what we're trying to achieve. And we think if we achieve this, you can achieve this, and we both win.
Yeah, and I think we can go on this conversation for forever. But I think, you know, both of y'all have touched upon such very, very important points around, you know, reframing around how do we value impact and how do we put a value to everything that we do. And unsurprisingly, through the discussions that we had while putting this report together, we spoke with lots and lots of freelancers, lots and lots of practitioners, and unsurprisingly, financial well-being was a very important part of these conversations and how that needs to be addressed, and how potentially this putting this thriving practice model in place could enable us to start that process of change and start that process of reframing how we measure impact and what is impactful within the healthcare, arts, and culture space. So thank you, some absolutely fantastic insights there. And I think we've already touched upon what I was going to ask next around how do we go about implementing these recommendations. But is there anything else that you would want to add on to what you've already mentioned in the past in the previous question? Go wild, anybody.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I will probably start using it straight away because I'm looking forward to sort of the next few years of our practice. We've developed quite a good relationship with our local mental health trust. And how can we build on that? So we're looking at sort of these bridging spaces between being on the ward and being discharged back into the community. How might a museum be that middle ground so that it's not such a harsh kind of, okay, you're on the ward, okay, now you're at home and you can't come back on the ward. Okay, you're at home, oh, now you're on the ward. But having a space in the middle and talking to various people about it. But now I think I'm actually going to use this to sort of sit down and go through point by point as a kind of like, what have I considered around this? What have I considered around production? What have I considered around time that I need to prepare? What have I considered around representation? I think for someone like me who gets really passionate and really energized and really overexcited about this kind of work, it's a really useful like step-by-step way to like contextualize my thoughts. I'm very good at having lots of thoughts at the same time, and it takes me longer to get it out on paper. So for me, this is like a gift.
I mean, I think the question in my mind is how many places already have the leadership that is thinking about this as an opportunity? How many places have got the appetite to use this as a framework? So I think there's a bit of work to do to identify some places, some organisations or some systems where actually they're ready to begin to experiment with this and use it as the basis of a conversation. I think the other thing that we got to in Calderdale is that this space between the worlds of creativity, health and well-being needs to be occupied by somebody who feels an ownership for that space. I wonder whether, I think you've got to give somebody the job of turning the wheel and making this happen. You know, I think we've got to put capacity in and capability in to enable a place to actually use this as a framework. And sometimes I think that might turn into somebody's job. We need to be willing to invest in asking somebody to take responsibility for cranking the machine on this.
Absolutely, 100% agree on that. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. It's been an absolute joy and privilege to have both of you join me in this conversation. But before I ask you all for your sort of final reflections, I always do torture my guest with a very random question, which has nothing to do with this report. But I think the whole idea is just for our listeners to probably get to know a little bit more about you as a person. So my random question for today's conversation is that if you were given a chance to travel anywhere in the world, time, money, resources not being a restraint or a restriction at all, where would you like to travel to and why? Matt, I see you smiling, so I'm gonna say, why don't you start us off on this one?
So I've thought about this question before. So it's not the first time I've thought about this question. I've been really lucky. I'm blessed. I've been blessed in my life, and I've been to a lot of places that are really, really, really beautiful. There are still places I'd like to go to, but I think if I could have my dreams come true, I'd just want to go back to a place I went to in Scotland, actually, by the sea on the west coast of Scotland, right up in the far northwest of Scotland, a place called Applecross. And it's a really wild and beautiful and remote spot, and the scenery is just amazing, and the wildlife is beautiful, and the children were small, and we had a really wonderful time just exploring this place. So I'm going to answer your question by saying I want to go there, but I want to go back in time to when the kids were small.
So my like when I'm daydreaming that I'm a billionaire with no sort of constraints or responsibilities, my ideal destination would be South America. So I've never been to South America, so I can't name like a specific place, but in my mind, I would have, so my favorite, one of my favorite animals, a capybara, and they are, they're basically giant rodents, but they're like super chill, and like they like bathing in hot water, and they adopt other animals, and they make friends with every single animal there is. They're just like mega chill, and I feel like living with like 15 of them on some kind of ranch, I'm imagining like sitting in like a wooden kind of cabin thing, like a nice glass of like Chilean white wine, watching my capybaras in the garden, mowing the lawn, yeah, watching the sunset. That'd do me all right, yeah.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Are you looking for people to join you, Gemma?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you're very welcome. Yeah.
Well, both these sort of destinations and holidays sound perfect. I've actually been to Amazon, and I've actually had the privilege of seeing quite a few capybaras. And I must say, I think my first interaction with them was one of those where I wasn't sure whether the capybara was scared of me or I was supposed to be scared of him. So we were just like staring at each other for a couple of minutes, be like, so who moves? Like who gets freaked out first? but I completely agree. They're so chill and they're so cute as well. So brilliant. Thank you so much for sort of indulging in my randomness. And from capybara, South America and Scotland, coming back to the space, any final reflections that you would want to share on the back of this conversation, or any final reflections about this report that you would like to share?
Yeah, I think my main kind of reflection is that I'm really glad that I'm in this sector, and it's really, I feel like I've joined it at a really good time. I remember starting, and whenever I spoke about art for well-being, people sort of, it was kind of seen as like a nice little addition. But I feel like it's nice to see, and really exciting to see the sector developing. And I think with this kind of idea of joined up working and moving away from kind of individual responsibilities and like individual kind of values driven projects to actually like really big strategic commitments is wonderful, and I'm so glad to be here.
So I'm thinking, and I think I said something along these lines earlier in the conversation, the issue here isn't the creative energy of people. The issue here isn't whether there's enough capability in the world. The issue here, I think, is are organisations ready to step into a conversation about how we create creative, energetic, happy places, and how do we value the people who create our joy and happiness with us. I think there's a, Gemma, you said earlier, we've been through a really difficult 2 or 3 years, and it doesn't feel to me as though it's going to get easier anytime soon. But I think what we know is that when times are hard, creative people get to work, and they respond to the hardship by helping us to understand its impact and creating ways of seeing the world that are different and hopeful. I think the challenge to organisations who commission and who provide health and well-being is, are you ready to capitalise on the energy that the creative community is going to create for itself? And how do we have a conversation about how we value that, how we work together to enable you to bring your skills into this space more effectively? Because I think creative energy is there, it's pent up, it's ready, and it's waiting to tell us, actually, this world could be a better place, and we've got a story to tell. I think organisations need to be ready to work with that.
What a powerful note to end this discussion on. Absolutely agree with both of you, Matt and Gemma, and I think we are, honestly, I think we are in a very exciting space within, you know, where we can take this the sector, creativity. So thank you very much to both of you. There's been some valuable, very, very valuable thoughts that we've discussed through this conversation. So absolutely, wholeheartedly, massive thank you to both of you for giving us your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with both of you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having us.
And really good to meet you both. Really good to meet you, Minotti, and you, Gemma.
What an incredible conversation that was. So much of depth, power, and variety. Thank you, Matt and Gemma. That has been an absolute joy. And don't forget that this conversation is a part of a podcast series that we have published on the website. So please do head to culturehealthandwellbeing.org.uk to tune in to the other episodes of this podcast series. Thank you very much for tuning in, and here's wishing you a brilliant, creative day ahead. This is Manoti Parekh signing off. Take care and be well.